This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Welcome back to another Thursday on the Damage Report. And I did have to ask if today was Thursday just to confirm before we started this show, because I am still discombobulated after coming back from my vacation. But I'm really happy to be here with all of you. We're going to cover a lot of stories. We're going to talk about the new Speaker of the House and maybe place some bets on how long he'll last. We're going to talk about Trump's ridiculous reaction during his court case and him storming out of there furious. Of course, we're going to give you the updates that we have now about the horrific mass shooting that happened in Maine last night and the ongoing situation and the manhunt for the person who did it. So we're going to talk about all that and a couple silly stories at the end. But joining me to talk about all of this is one of my favorite people to host with, Sharon Reed. Sharon, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, I just love being on with you. I hope I don't say anything too outrageous, but you never know. It is Thursday, Friday Eve. I might behave.
Well, you know, I'm actually hoping that you do say something outrageous.
Oh, good. Green light.
All right. Are you ready to jump into this first story?
Let's do it.
All right, everybody. The circus has come to a close for now because we can finally put a pin in the speaker's race. After 22 days, Republicans have finally found a person they can agree on. Again, for now. No telling how long he will hold the job. So Representative Mike Johnson, a relatively and little known Louisiana Republican and a low ranking member of the GOP leadership team, became the Republicans' final nominee for House Speaker Tuesday night after three other hopefuls fizzled out. Those three people being Scalise, Jordan and Tom Emmer, who I think had the funniest saga, the shortest lived chance of becoming Speaker of the House. Just nominated, resigned immediately. But let's talk about Mike Johnson and who he is. And let's let him do it in his own words. So here he is introducing himself with this clip from his first speech as Speaker of the House.
I want to tell all my colleagues here what I told the Republicans in that room last night. I don't believe there are any coincidences in a matter like this. I believe that Scripture, the Bible, is very clear. That God is the one that raises up those in authority. He raised up each of you, all of us. And I believe that God has ordained and allowed each one of us to be brought here for this specific moment in this time.
He is a religious nut. There he was ascending to a very high role, you know, third in line for the president, talking about his religion, thumping his Bible in our supposedly secular government. I mean, we invade countries for being a theocracy. We go into other countries and topple their governments because of them being based on religion. But here we have, again, third in line for president of the United States, talking about how he was brought here by religion. And we know that he loves to introduce legislation on the basis of his religion. So let's go to this reporting from CNN. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson has a history of harsh anti-gay language from his time as an attorney for a socially conservative legal group in the mid-aughts. Johnson called homosexuality a inherently unnatural and dangerous lifestyle that would lead to legalized pedophilia and possibly even destroy, quote, the entire democratic system. Ironic thing here is if homosexuality, as he called it, would actually destroy the entire democratic system, he would support it. He would be leading the pride parade, waving the rainbow flag, because this is a man who has done everything in his power to destroy democracy in our country. And I'm not making this up. I'm not, you know, aggrandizing the situation. It's just facts. This is an election denier. from Axios. In December 2020, Johnson led an amicus brief signed by more than 100 House Republicans in support of a failed Texas lawsuit that sought to invalidate Biden's election victory in four swing states. Johnson also trafficked in a baseless conspiracy theory in November 2020 about, quote, rigged Dominion voting machines, allegedly having ties to deceased Venezuelan dictator Hugo Chavez. And as you probably assumed, based on his putting religion at the front of his politics, he is one of the worst in the House of Representatives on the issue of abortion. Take a look.
Roe v. Wade gave constitutional cover to the elective killing of unborn children in America, period. You think about the implications of that on the economy. We're all struggling here to cover the bases of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and all the rest. If we had all those able-bodied workers in the economy, we wouldn't be going upside down and toppling over like this. Listen,
the gentleman,
I will not yield. I will not. Roe was a terrible corruption of America's constitutional jurisprudence.
There is something ironic about him talking about Social Security and Medicare there, because he supports ending those programs. He has in no uncertain terms said that he supports privatizing those programs. And there he was using his supposed support of those systems as justification for why we need to get rid of legal abortion in this country, which, mind you, when abortion is restricted, more abortions happen. They're just happening in unsafe ways, in unsafe conditions, putting the lives of more pregnant people at risk. But they don't care about that. They're not pro-life. They're pro-forced birth. And he's going to have to work pretty hard with this impending government shutdown, as well as military aid for Israel and Ukraine, which, I'll just say this, Gaza won't see another dollar with Johnson in charge, I'm sure. And he's also very vehemently opposed aid to Ukraine as well. So it'll be interesting to see how these things play out. I've got a little bit more on the Republican reaction and celebration of this man. But first, Sharon, I want to bring you in and get your thoughts on this person who is, he's not hiding the fact that his religious values is how he's going to lead what is supposed to be our secular government.
He calls it religion. I call it a cult. Okay. He's diabolical in his dysfunction. He is far worse than Speaker 55. 56 is far worse. Radical. Have you ever heard his podcast? I tried to listen for a few minutes. He and his wife have this podcast where they go over everything that's in the headlines, cultural wars, the war on women, which he loves. They love. I mean, she co-signs on that. And it was very difficult to even stomach it. I'm a journalist. I'm trying to gather information here. I couldn't even stomach it. I think God is very angry. If you believe God, wait, what's that? God is very angry. Okay, I just heard from God. Stop invoking the Lord's name in this destructive thing that you're pushing against gay people, women, children, everyone. Who do you love? Who do you love? That would be a great question to ask, but the reporter would probably just get shouted down like the other day.
They were already scared to have to answer for his leading the charge to overturn democracy in our country. The entire party was yelling, shut up to this reporter who asked
political genius.
Right. And she asked a salient question, a reasonable question to ask this person who has in no uncertain terms been very public about his support for overturning democracy, for overturning the election. I mean, he was the very vocal leader of that movement in the House, despite his lack of seniority within the party. But when you ask him about it, then you're going to be met with, shut up. Now is not the time to talk about policy, which I thought was interesting. Maybe I can get your thoughts on that. Because, you know, and what we've seen throughout this debacle with the speakership is it's not an issue of policy, right? This is a party that, you know, agrees on a lot of these issues. They agree on not certifying the election results. They agree on, you know, severely restricting or completely ending a woman's right to choose, demonizing and legislating away protections for gay people. So him saying now is not the time for policy. I mean, it hasn't been the time for policy. This has been a naked power grab by very Trump aligned members of the Republican Party.
Yeah, they're not getting anything done. Thank goodness. Okay. they've wreaked havoc. They've created divide, hate. You know, I know we're going to cover another mass shooting. They haven't even caught the guy yet, but I believe it's all connected to the society we live in today. America, look at your life. Anybody who thinks the Republican Party is distancing itself from that thing and that insurrection thing, okay, they're not. They're more on board than ever. This thing where you heard pundits say it over and over again that I think there's a crack, they've had enough. No, the guy with the plastic hair, what kind of gel is that? Now that does fascinate me. He wanted to get rid of the other guy because, you know, neither one of them could trust the other and they just don't like each other. And now he's running all over town and doing interviews. If that's your biggest cheerleader, that's all we need to know. The Republican Party is still going to be up to these shenanigans and they won't stop unless they're forced to stop or we all suffer to the end.
Absolutely. And we'll talk more about that mass shooting and some of the right-wing figures, the tweets of whom he was liking before this mass shooting, which gives us some insight into how he was, his political views. But let's talk about Matt Gaetz, because his opposition to Kevin McCarthy, we now know, was primarily that Kevin McCarthy didn't have the authority to, and said as much to Matt Gaetz, to get rid of the House ethics investigation into Matt Gaetz's sexual impropriety and his activities with underage girls that's being currently investigated in the House. He demanded Kevin McCarthy repeal that investigation, you know, rebuke it. He didn't have the authority to do that. And so Matt Gaetz has been antagonistic to him the whole time. He's not, however, antagonistic towards Mike Johnson, which would lead me to be curious as to the types of promises Johnson has made to Matt Gaetz behind closed doors. But here he is, ecstatic.
MAGA is ascendant. And if you don't think that moving from Kevin McCarthy to MAGA Mike Johnson shows the ascendance of this movement and where the power in the Republican Party truly lies, then you're not paying attention.
MAGA Mike, he called him MAGA Mike, like Magic Mike, but nobody wants to watch it. Yeah. And it's severely unsexy. MAGA Mike. Now, Trump also echoed the similar sentiment on his Truth Social media platform. He tweeted this out, or posted this, excuse me. MAGA Mike Johnson. Apparently, they have found their line of messaging. And some Republicans are attempting to pull the wool over our eyes. Here's this from Politico. Representative Brian Fitzpatrick said, quote, "We stand by the fact that Joe Biden was legitimately elected president of the United States. We disagree with Mike on that," Fitzpatrick continued. "And I'm not sure Mike would do the same thing today," which is so ironic. And then clearly one side has got their messaging. The other side is attempting to, again, pull the wool over your eyes. Because this side is championing him. They're saying, this is our guy. This is MAGA Mike. MAGA Mike Johnson. The other side is saying, well, he wouldn't have done the same thing today, which I think is a pretty difficult argument to make when the people who benefited from what he did then are celebrating him. Of course, you know, there are Republican representatives in purple districts who are facing tough re-elections who are now going to have to explain to their voter bases and these not Trump strongholds, these districts that Biden won, they're going to have to explain to their voter bases why the leader now essentially of their party, caucus in the House is somebody who wanted to overturn democracy as we know it in our country. And I think it's going to bode pretty unwell for those Republicans. We'll see how that plays out. But apparently Biden doesn't seem concerned about an election denier as speaker. Again, let me correct what I said earlier. I said third in line, second in line to the presidency goes Kamala Harris, then Speaker of the House. Second in line to the presidency. This from Politico. Biden, for his part, dismissed concerns that Johnson would overturn 2024 election results as Speaker. "Just like I was not worried that the last guy would be able to overturn the election," Biden said in a press conference on Wednesday. Here's what leader Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader of the House, had to say. "Mike Johnson wants to criminalize abortion care and impose a nationwide ban. Mike Johnson was one of the chief architects of trying to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Mike Johnson also wants to end Social Security and Medicare as we know it. Those are extreme views, and House Democrats will push back aggressively against that. Anybody who knows me knows that I am no friend to Hakeem Jeffries, that I have no support for him whatsoever. But I'll say that's a good statement, much better than I believe the statement from Joe Biden. I think that whether or not this person, again, who led the charge to overturn the Democratic results of the 2020 election is willing to do the same thing in 2024, he absolutely is. And I'm glad that the minority leader was willing to say those things and point out how abhorrent this man has been on policy. Now, of everyone, though, I think Jamie Raskin said it best. So let's hear from him.
It's inconceivable that you could get to the right of him. I mean, there are people who are definitely more lunatic than he is. And he's got very good manners and he's an able lawyer. But when we say he opposed democracy, we know that from his giving a legal gloss and finish to all of Donald Trump's arguments about electoral fraud. But if he's not for democracy, what's he for? He's for theocracy. He wants a nationwide ban on abortion with no exceptions for rape or incest. He's also voted against reaffirming women's contraceptive rights. He is a real enemy of Social Security. From my perspective, he wanted to increase the age of Social Security retirement to 70.
And Raskin laid it out perfectly. There was, you know, obviously in the limited time he had there, he couldn't fit in every specific criticism of this man, but I think he gave a good overview of all the reasons why he is a dangerous individual. I think the reason, though, why he's the most dangerous, Sharon, and I'll get your thoughts on this in a second, is because and we talked so much about how Kevin McCarthy was spineless. This man is going to be a perfect resource for those in the Republican Party who represent R plus 6,000 districts who never have to fear about, you know, catching the ire of their more moderate electorate. And he will capitulate to them time and time and time again. And all the good things that we need our government to do to continue to fund programs that actually benefit people is not going to happen. And it's instead going to become or continue to be a circus being led by the most reactionary elements inside this already fairly fascistic party. And he's going to give them everything they ever wanted. And he's the perfect guy to do it because he has even less of a backbone than Kevin McCarthy. And he's not even going to pretend that he cares about I won't call them the more moderate members of the party, but the members of the party that represent moderate districts. He's a dangerous, dangerous person. And I'll just end on this because I want to be able to point this out. This is a man who introduced legislation that would have classified a book, a children's book, where a character has gay parents on the same level as hardcore pornography being shown to children. This man is your political enemy to everybody watching, a very dangerous individual. And it is horrifying that he's been able to ascend in a relatively short amount of time to such a position of power.
And he has no shame, none. You know, shame is a good thing. I think it was created to keep us in check sometimes. Are you ashamed? You're blushing, you're embarrassed by your behavior? None. So when you say he's a very dangerous man, you nailed it. Here's a guy, and I just happened to be perusing an article entitled, tells you everything you need to know, by the way, What Black People Should Know About the New U.S. Speaker. Got it. You don't even have to go a paragraph in. Argued against reparations. Oh, okay. Did nothing to advance equity, but is, again, without shame and pushing forward a 14-year-old Black child that he and his wife took in to say, I know about discrimination too. You are discrimination. And can we please put out a BOLO? Can we please find the child? I don't know how old this child is, but I'm concerned. I really am concerned because this is a man who will fearlessly, you know, I know you said he has no backbone, but he will fearlessly walk with his Cliff Notes version of, I don't know where he's getting this Bible that tells him what to do. And it sounded like when you played that first clip of him towards the beginning, he was saying that he's royalty. He's been anointed. That he's been anointed. That's why he's now the Speaker of the House instead of this huge debacle, okay, that Elise Stefanik of New York wants us to believe was a masterful thing and a beautiful thing. It wasn't, she said it. It was a quote. Not dysfunction, not chaos. This gave them a chance to pause and take a beautiful risk, paraphrasing, on the right side of history. It's crazy. I'd rather them just, you know, make faces and yell at the reporters instead of someone quoting that.
Talk about shameless.
Right.
Trying to portray this as anything but the absolute circus it has been for about a month now. And it is so self-righteous for him to stand up there and essentially say that he's ruling over the House of Representatives by divine right.
Wow.
He was achieved this through his, you know, what I'd say is a massive misinterpretation of his religion and using that to justify, you know, all of the forms of bigotry that he's going to champion over the, you know, next year or so, however long Republicans retain their control over the House and however long he retains his control over the Republicans of the House. Again, we'll see, because Kevin McCarthy didn't even last a year, but he wasn't necessarily playing ball to the extent that Matt Gaetz and the other Republicans wanted him to. It seems like they found their guy. We'll keep everybody updated on these developments and what the Republicans do with this power, and more importantly, what they don't do with it. But with that, we've got to go to our first break. Stick around, because we're going to talk about Donald Trump's little temper tantrum after this. All right, before we get into our story about Trump's temper tantrum, and I am reveling in this story a little bit, I do want to read this comment from Colin Hutton, super chat. Thank you for the super chat. Says, these ladies are TYT MVPs. Ray's been holding down the main show in TDR since John is on hiatus, and Sharon always has her doctor's smock ready to hold down the good doctor's office when needed. Well, thank you so much for that.
Appreciate it.
Oh, I love the good messages, especially when I love that they curate these good messages when I have the chat pulled open out of the corner of my eye. And for some reason, I only ever look over when there's something bad.
So that it's part. Always good. Nice. Yeah.
Okay.
Balances out.
Let's talk about Donald Trump and how his inability to shut the hell up has cost him quite a bit of money. Take a look.
This was a trial that should have never been brought, but if we had a jury, it would have been fair, at least, even if it was a somewhat negative jury, because no negative jury would vote against it. But this judge will, because this judge is a very partisan judge, with a person who's very partisan sitting alongside him, perhaps even much more partisan than he is. So we are doing very well. The facts are speaking very loud. He's a totally discredited witness, and you haven't seen anything yet. This goes on for a long time, but he's a totally discredited witness.
Somebody call the Whambulance, because Donald Trump is having a hissy fit once again. He stormed out of a New York courthouse after day two of testimony from his former fixer, Michael Cohen. That statement he just made there that you saw cost him, because a judge slapped him with a $10,000 fine for violating the gag order again. Not even the first time. He's doing it again. Now, here's some details from that fine that he received from the New York Times. The judge, Arthur F. Engoron, who is presiding over Mr. Trump's civil fraud trial, issued the punishment after determining that Mr. Trump had violated an order against discussing court staff when he spoke to reporters earlier in the day. So when Trump said the person next to the judge is even more partisan, the judge said Trump is not allowed to criticize his staff. Trump pretended he wasn't talking about the clerk, but was talking about Michael Cohen, which makes no sense. And the judge rightfully pointed that out, considering that Michael Cohen worked for Donald Trump for a long time, went to jail for something that he did in service of Donald Trump. Partisan? Make it make sense. So that's when the judge forced Trump to up to the stand to explain himself. from the New York Times. From the stand, Mr. Trump, wearing a Navy suit and curtailing his usual monologue, insisted that his spontaneous comments in the courthouse hallway had been about his former lawyer, Michael D. Cohen, a witness. They were not, he said, about the judge's law clerk, Allison Greenfield, whom he had previously attacked on social media. But Mr. Trump testified that he thought Ms. Greenfield was, quote, maybe unfair, and I think she's very biased against us. He left the stand after about 3 minutes, and Justice Ngoron made his pronouncement almost immediately afterward. I find that the witness is not credible, he said, and levied the fine as Mr. Trump stared blankly ahead. I am very protective of my staff, Justice Ngoron said, adding, I don't want anybody killed, which is rightfully a thing to be afraid of when you have the most, potentially the most high profile, you know, defendant sitting in front of you in your courtroom that has unfettered access to the media and a captive audience listening to every word he says, who's levied that audience to already commit acts of violence. So the fear that someone in his staff might get killed is a very real fear, a fear that I'm sure he also holds for himself and the members of his family. This finally, I'll read from that same article. Justice Ngoron had already fined Mr. Trump $5,000 last week for comments he made about Ms. Greenfield. That first violation was something of a technicality. Though the comments were deleted from social media, they had also been posted to Mr. Trump's website and were not taken down for weeks. Now, if or really when Trump violates the gag order again, he will most likely get a higher fine. Now, the judge has threatened to Trump that throwing him in jail is possible, but definitely unlikely. He did say that the $10,000 fine was on the liberal side. But, you know, Donald Trump will probably do what he's already been doing and use the donations from his supporters to pay for that fine, as he has been using them to pay for his attorney's fees and all of his other legal expenses. Sharon, I think it's really interesting that Donald Trump can't stop attacking this judge because he asked for a bench trial, right? Donald Trump could have a jury. These decisions could be getting made by a jury. Instead, he requested the judge to make these decisions. In this case, his attorneys put in that request, and now he's attacking the sole trier of fact in his case. It doesn't make sense, but I don't expect Donald Trump's actions to make a lot of sense.
No, he's not the brightest, but I do think that I understand his motivation here, because he can't do a jury trial. Who will you bully? I mean, there's plenty to pick from, but if you want to just focus on one person, the trial may not last long enough for him to get to everybody. So this way, he has one person to bully, one person to focus on, one person that he thinks these same tricks. He has zero control, zero discipline. And I don't even know why the $10,000 kind of irked me. It's a nice figure, unless you've been ripping off the public for, you know, how many years now? And small business owners, private contractors, and a lot of other people too. I don't know why you'd even put him on the stand though. Mm-hmm. Couldn't you just play his prior statement? Like the guy who stood in Helsinki and said, I don't know why it would beat Russia. And then 24 hours later, when his aide scribbled something down, said, read this. He said, no, I made myself clear. What I said was, I don't know why it wouldn't beat Russia. This is silly. You know, you go to your kid, there's crumbs all over her mouth. The cookie jar is empty, okay? The lid's off. And she tells you this ridiculous lie, okay? While she's laughing, okay? That's what we're getting here. This is an exercise in dippy. I don't know another word for it. It's come to the point where it's just dippy. Mm-hmm. It's dippy. I don't even want to watch, but I will watch. I actually will watch.
And it's funny because you're right. It also irked me that low figure. And as I mentioned, and Ngoron himself said it was on the liberal side of things, because you have sitting in front of you a man who has bragged that he's the richest person in the world. We know it's not true, but he brags about it. You have sitting in front of you the least credible person potentially ever. When he said, I find the witness not credible, all I could think was, yeah, no duh. Of course, the witness is not credible. He's Donald Trump. Nothing he says should be taken seriously. Cohen testified before Congress that Trump's financial statements were filled with fraudulent values calculated to attain his desired overall net worth. New York Times reported, Mr. Cohen repeated those statements on Tuesday, his first day of testimony, when questioned by a lawyer from the Attorney General's office. He also spoke about his involvement in deals in which Mr. Trump's financial statements were used to showcase the former president's wealth and financial power. But on Wednesday, Mr. Trump's lawyers provoked Mr. Cohen by pointing out his inconsistencies. At one point, Mr. Keyes called him a perjurious witness who has lied to everyone he's ever spoken to. Again, an ironic argument to make when your client is Donald Trump, but not inherently untrue as it pertains to Michael Cohen. Continues on, Trump's lawyer, Alina Haba, suggested that Mr. Cohen had contradicted himself in describing his work on the financial statements. For example, she noted that he said in a deposition that he had worked on, quote, almost every asset, whereas at the trial on Tuesday, he said that he had worked only on a limited number. So this is when Cohen started tripping over rapid fire questions from a third Trump lawyer, Clifford S. Robert. At one point, Mr. Cohen said he did not recall Mr. Trump directing him to inflate the numbers on his financial statements. Mr. Trump threw up his hands as if to proclaim his innocence. After Mr. Cohen made that admission, Mr. Robert asked Justice Engoron to dismiss the case, a request the judge immediately denied, leading Mr. Trump to push back his chair and storm out of the room. And I'll add this before I continue on. He's allowed to storm out of the room because he doesn't have to be there. He continues to frame it as though they're undermining democracy in our country by forcing him to forego campaigning, to get off the campaign trail and to be hunkered down in New York to attend this trial. He doesn't have to be there. Again, evidenced by the fact that he just left. And in previous proceedings, he didn't get up because he was upset. He got up to go golfing. He got up, he hopped on a plane, he went to Florida and hit his golf course. Again, just keep in mind, every time he tries to pass off that framing that he's being forced to be there, that he can't campaign because he has to be there. He literally doesn't. He literally does not have to be there. All right, let's keep going though. But when Mr. Robert again sought an early verdict, Justice Engoron said that he did not necessarily consider Mr. Cohen to be a key witness, adding, there's enough evidence in this case to fill this courtroom. Not something you want the judge to say about you. In a statement, Ms. James echoed that assessment, saying her case was based on hundreds of thousands of documents and many, many witnesses. Now, of course, Donald Trump had to again take to social media to talk about this trial, despite the gag order. It said this, the New York State Attorney General's case against me is dead. I'm sorry, made me laugh because we just read the judge say you could fill the courtroom with all of the evidence against him. But here's Donald Trump saying it's dead. But the radical left judge refuses to end it. He just can't let it go. Their, quote, star witness lied like a dog on the stand today and then admitted that I did nothing wrong. A total sleazebag. He continues on and on with all of his lies. I'm not going to read all of them because I don't want to give them all that air, that time on our network. But Sharon, this man opens his mouth and lies. It's just all lies. He can't stop himself. He pulls open his phone and lies and lies and lies and lies. So if he does eventually have to take the stand in this trial, he hasn't been called yet, but if he does have to testify in this trial, it seems almost like a fruitless or pointless effort because we all know what he's going to do. He had to take the stand in the separate matter about the gag order and he lied. So if he has to testify about the inflated assets, we know what he's going to do. He's going to lie.
Yeah. So it's about the theater of it. You know, it's an exercise. Maybe he won't show that day and just given what the lawyers call the negative inference or something. He's going to lose anyway. It's not going to matter. But he may want to put on a show. The problem for him is going to be not just that he's a bad liar. He's not telling these intricate, you know, exciting lies where it's the end of the game and you're trying to figure out who done it. You know, the butler did. We don't know who did it. With him, it's always him. But I do think he thinks that he can control that process. He'll get on the stand. He'll filibuster. He'll keep going. He won't answer the question. He'll answer anything but the question. But maybe that's fun. I think I'm bored with it, but then I've been bored for perhaps a couple of years with it. Maybe there's an audience for this. But I don't see court TV clamoring to, you know, go gavel to gavel on this one, even with the sketches, because it's just not that interesting. Liars gonna lie.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, essentially, he's already been found liable to have done these things. Really, this is just a matter of punishment, of sentencing, of what he's going to have to pay. So, but you know, it is a little boring, but we'll keep you all updated and on his antics, on what he's been saying and all of his lies and refuting those. But with that said, we're going to go to our break. We'll be back and we're going to discuss the horrific mass shooting in Maine and the manhunt that has been going on to find the person who did this. I think that's a good read of the psyche of Donald Trump, for sure. But all right, we have to massively switch gears and talk about this horrific, and I'll say avoidable, tragedy in Maine. Avoidable if we actually did anything meaningful in this country to address gun control, but we haven't. So the latest on the situation in Maine, 18 people so far have been confirmed killed, and at least 13 were injured in mass shootings at a restaurant and a bowling alley in Lewiston, Maine on Wednesday night. Now, as of now, the suspect has not been apprehended. However, his vehicle has been found. There is a massive manhunt underway. So again, we have limited information coming out at this time. It's still relatively breaking news, and the manhunt is still underway. So we have not everything has been confirmed yet, but here is what we can say we know right now. From Associated Press, the shooting appears to have unfolded in multiple locations, including a bowling alley where a children's league was taking place and a local bar, official said. The death toll may be revised up or down due to the level of carnage, a senior federal law enforcement official said. Police bulletin identified Robert Card, 40 years old, as a person of interest in the attack that sent panicked bowlers scrambling behind pins when shots rang out around 7 p.m. Wednesday. Card was described as a firearms instructor believed to be in the Army Reserve and assigned to a training facility in Saco, Maine. Now, usually we would not show you a picture of a mass shooter, but because he is a person of interest and there is a massive manhunt underway currently, we are going to show his picture. Here it is. Just for the safety of our audience, to be careful if you see this man and alert law enforcement if you have any information on his potential whereabouts. A little bit more from Associated Press. The document circulated to law enforcement officials said Card had been committed to a mental health facility for 2 weeks in the summer of 2023. It did not provide details about his treatment or condition, but said Card had reported, quote, hearing voices and threats to shoot up the military base. Telephone number listed for Card in public records was not in service. So, you know, Sharon, I've covered so many of these stories now. It's just in the short time I've been working for TYT, because this country refuses to take any sort of meaningful action to curtail gun violence. And every time one of these stories breaks, the right-wing reaction always seems to be, now is not the time to talk about politics. But we then see the families of these victims say, no, now is the time, because my relative might still be alive if we actually took meaningful action to ensure that guns don't get in the hands of dangerous people. And now we know that this is someone who has made threats in the past to carry out shootings. Clearly someone who should not have had access to a firearm, but was still able to. In fact, he was still able to be a firearms instructor.
Yeah. Well, I think that we often focus on the morally corrupt side, the side that lacks integrity. We all know the right thing to do here, but you're pretending that you don't. That side, all in on it. They're not going to do anything. Even when children lay dying in the street, it just is that simple. So I like to sometimes focus on the other side, who could do something here. And that includes the American people who are being held hostage by these tiny, tiny groups with some money, checkbooks that they're willing to just throw it around to get their way. And their way is about carnage, bloodshed, and carnage. If we really wanted to do something here, if the White House, the Democrats, and I'm not saying that they don't, but they don't have good political game. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a fiery preacher who just like, maybe you don't feel like going to church. I haven't been in years, but anyway. But they get you going. And they energize you. It's a movement, a political figure, someone, something that you rally behind because you just a dance move, something. But they just stay flat-footed. I'm tired of the slow singing and flower bringing. I saw where Vice President Harris reacted. She's done nothing wrong. And I'm not calling her out as someone who did something wrong and being human in that moment. I don't want to hear about the healer in chief and, you know, his grief and how this is what he does best. It's all true. But if we want to end this thing and make some sense and not have there be more guns than people so that our kids can live, we can live, we can go bowling if that's what you're into, or go to a nightclub in Orlando, then we really could do it. We actually could do it. It would just take concentration, a strategy, a will to not drop it. We're into what? The next day, and it already feels like it's been three. You can't drop it. You have to say, I can't have another meal. I can't breathe until this gets done. And there's a price to pay if it doesn't. And I just don't see that commitment. It's like, give in to evil because they're never going to help us. No.
That is an excellent point, because so we have right now information. We know that gun violence has become the leading cause of death of children in this country. And if that isn't something that makes the Democrats angry, the ones in power angry enough to be leading the charge against gun violence, for gun control, for gun reform in our laws, I don't know what could. I mean, this is, and of course, it's not just children who are being murdered by guns, but that, you know, the image of a dead child is something that I think really is powerful in moving people towards demanding change. And we know how many kids in this country are getting murdered by guns, and it's still not enough for them to champion this issue. I mean, of course, there are Democrats who have been fighting on this issue. There's organizations, parents of people who have lost their children to gun control, who are fighting for who are fighting and championing this issue. But it hasn't come top down, right? This isn't something I've seen Joe Biden particularly impassioned about. You're right on the healer in chief language. But they can't heal if they know that in a couple days they're going to see another news story about another mass shooting that's happening. That healing can't occur until we change our laws. But that's all we have. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. And I think you're right. And I hate to bring her up again because can this woman rest? Okay. She refused to give up her seat on the bus all those years ago. And there were boycotts, and it almost brought an industry in a city to broke. Okay. You needed people to ride buses. Okay. You needed, you know, when sanitation workers said, I'm done, but they didn't just do it for a day or two. And it was an incredible sacrifice. How many miles are you walking to work today? Okay. And so I don't want to oversimplify it, but this is just a feeling I get. Polls aren't everything. Okay. And when you can look someone in the eye and they know you mean it and you're not going away, sometimes things happen. Okay. Even the sinister side had resolve and commitment. And they said, we're doing this. Okay. They wore hats and had that stupid slogan about making America great. It's a commitment, whether you're on the side of evil or semi-good, it's a commitment. And I remember I was on a ladder decorating a tree in St. Louis before I went to work, when the news was on, as it always is, and I heard, I think it was John Miller, the law enforcement guy, on one of the networks, CBS, I think. And I'll never forget hearing his voice and realizing what was coming. It was like he had to like prepare us so I wouldn't fall off that ladder. And he said things like, now it's just preliminary. This is what, he's a law enforcement source. So you knew it was coming when he said, there are children. And every year around this time, and other times I think about it, like when that big mouth is ordered to pay $1 billion and some, and he's still doing this trash. Do people care when kids are dead? Do they really care? It doesn't feel like they do. I can't imagine what those parents are still going through if I can't forget the horror of hearing those words.
It's a nightmare that they can't wake up from because they have to continue to fight to make sure it doesn't happen to anyone else's children. And it's sad. And I think you're right. It feels like every time that there is no action on this, it feels like nobody cares.
Yeah.
All right. Let's juxtapose this with some seemingly good news about unions in this country. And let's go ahead and watch this video.
Today, we reached a tentative agreement with Ford. For months, we've said that record profits mean record contracts. And UAW family, our stand-up strike has delivered.
The United Auto Workers Union and Ford have reached a tentative agreement that will end a nearly six-week strike at the automaker, the union announced Wednesday night. So a little more on that from CNBC. The tentative deal, which was first reported earlier by CNBC, includes 25% pay increases over the terms of the agreement and will cumulatively raise the top wage to more than $40 an hour, including an increase of 68% for starting wages to over $28 an hour. It also includes reinstatement of cost of living adjustments, a three-year path to top wages, and right to strike over plant closures, among other significantly enhanced benefits. So the union said gains in the deal are valid at more than four times the gains from the 2019 contract and provide more in base wage increases than Ford workers have received in the past 22 years. I have been following this and I couldn't believe it when I heard that number, to more than they've ever received in 22 years. So is the strike over at Ford? Yes and no. The tentative deal still must be approved by local UAW leaders and then ratified by a simple majority of Ford's 57,000 union-represented workers. The union will hold informational meetings as well as an online briefing to discuss specifics on the agreement, which will be posted online with summaries. But auto workers who are currently on strike with Ford will return to work while the union's approval and voting process occurs, according to the UAW Vice President Chuck Browning. And here is him explaining why that is.
Like everything we've done in this stand-up strike, this is a strategic move to get the best deal possible. We're going back to work at Ford to keep the pressure on Stellantis and GM. The last thing they want is for Ford to get back to full capacity while they mess around and lag behind. Members will be receiving further instructions on the process for returning to work soon.
Now, just a little more from CNBC. Ford, in a statement, said that it was, quote, pleased to have reached a tentative agreement. The company is now focused on restarting production at the Kentucky truck plant, the Michigan assembly plant, and the Chicago assembly plant, where the union initiated walkouts of roughly 16,600 workers. Now, Fain talked a bit about what's next and what brought this deal from Ford.
On Monday, we called on our UAW family at Sterling Heights Assembly to stand up. That is Stellantis' biggest and most profitable plant. On Tuesday, our UAW family at Arlington Assembly answered the call, and they went out on strike, shutting down GM's biggest and most profitable plant. Ford knew what was coming for them on Wednesday if we didn't get a deal. That was checkmate.
So the UAW is still negotiating with GM and Stellantis. But Sharon, this feels like very good news for those UAW-represented workers at Ford.
That does. And I don't know if it just feels this way or it really is happening. But there's this wave across several industries where workers have taken back the momentum and they're sort of kind of winning. And it reminds me of the last story we did about commitment and resolve and sticking together and saying, I don't care about your math. I don't care about your version of the economy. We can't make it this way. And we just deserve more. We're doing all the work and you're taking all the profits and it's still not enough. You're so greedy. So listen, the others, they'll go as well. they'll fall as well and they'll make a deal and workers will be better off for it.
Absolutely. There's been a massive increase in union activity and it feels really good to see people committed and winning. And I know all the Ford workers with the UAW are going to stand in solidarity with the workers at Stellantis and GM until they get a fair deal. But we'll keep you updated on that. That's all the time we have. So hold on to your butts because the aftermath is coming up after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.